WXCO, 1230 AM, W255 DN, Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. During what has become the second longest government shutdown in U.S. history, many federal workers are not being paid. And GOP Senator Ted Cruz of Texas tells CBS News that includes air traffic controllers.
We're seeing delays. Houston Hobby Airport last night had a ground stop because of a shortage of air traffic controllers. And these problems will only get worse.
Sources tell CBS News that a Border Patrol immigration crackdown is expanding to San Francisco. California Governor Gavin Newsom calls it absolutely predictable.
This administration, you send first masked men to the cities that you want to militarize.
The U.S. is imposing new sanctions against Russia after a failure to end the war in Ukraine and deadly drone and missile attacks by Russia overnight. CBS's Aaron Navarro reports.
The sanctions will target the Rosneft and Lukoil oil companies as well as their subsidies.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
You're listening to 98.9 WXCO, Wausau's home for the Todd Allball Show, weekday afternoons from 2 to 4.
Bucks basketball tonight. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Milwaukee Bucks season tips off at 7 o'clock against the Washington Wizards and former Bucks star Chris Middleton. How's he doing a year after having surgery on both of his ankles?
Man, life is good. I feel refreshed for one. Great offseason where I just got to work on myself. Not have to worry about going into procedures or, you know, a long rehab. So I'm definitely feeling refreshed and, you know, blessed and thankful to still be playing. And, you know, I'm excited for this year.
Bucks head coach Doc Rivers instructed the Five Surf Forum scoreboard crew to produce a video tribute for Middleton. How are fans going to react to seeing him in a Wizards uniform?
Are you think the fans are going to boo? Of course not. They're not. We traded him. He won a title for us, and he's a Buck, and he's part of this community. And I think that's what people forget most. As good as he was off on the court, I thought he was a superstar off the court, him and his wife, with all the things they did for the community.
That's Bucks head coach Doc Rivers with Sports on Mike Clemens.
I love playing sports, especially for my school. And that's because school sports are special. It's where it's safe to fail. It's where we're taught resilience, where our fear becomes confidence. It's where we learn to get back up after every fall. School sports are where 7.8 million students go from I can't to I can.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
This is Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Oh, the fun, more entertainment, and, evidently another Trump nominee going down. Shocked? And the thing is we're watching the Republican Party being peeled like an onion. Layer after embarrassing layer, layer after infuriating layer. And honestly, kind of about time. And I look at the fact that Paul Ingrazia, Trump's nominee to head the Office of Special Counsel, he didn't just stumble over the line, so to speak. It wasn't a, you know, oops, it was, I misspoke. No, he proudly stomped over the line, through the line, and rubbed people's noses in it, proudly claiming to have a Nazi streak, spewing his racist, anti-Semitic, and downright hateful texts like little badges of honor. Evidently, Martin Luther King Jr.'s holiday, according to him, should be tossed into the seventh circle of hell. And the weird thing is these weren't, you know, there were no secret leaks of his stuff, no deep forensic digging needed. Ingrazia made sure everyone knew exactly who he is, what he is, what he believes, and he wears it like, he wears his bigotry like a medal, like a badge of honor. And look, this isn't just one rogue lawyer. It's part of a pattern so blatant that even some Republican senators, yeah, some are, a few now, openly not thrilled. In fact, seven, I guess, had said that they weren't going to maybe not vote for him, which is kind of why he pulled his name from the nomination. Ron Johnson, who I don't agree with and I think is a terrible senator, flatly came out and said it should have never gotten this far. Senate Majority Leader John Thune laughed it off as a bad joke gone too far. And the thing is this is a rare moment when the far right's excesses are getting flagged, not by people like me, not by people who don't like the Trump administration, but by their own side. It really reveals a deeper rot that's been festering in the Republican Party under Trump's watch for sure, but for decades before. And for Republican voters who don't buy into this white nationalist misogynistic circus, there's a moment here. There's an opportunity, a moment of clarity, if you will. But understand, the party has long been a vehicle, not just for conservative ideas, but for extremist voices to openly glorify hate, deny historical atrocities, and of course, dismiss Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy as something to be tossed into hell. We just came off of the young operatives, the young Republicans, exposed by their racist group chats. And as I said then, they're not the outlier. They're part of the broader acceptance of extremism that's been normalized and shrugged off by Republican leaders. I look at J.D. Vance. He defended Nazi-loving texts as college group chat banter. That's the normalization of hate in full throttle. And yet, for decent Republicans, and I know there are some, by independents who feel trapped or disillusioned, the Republicans unraveling, this is an opportunity to shed these abhorrent elements, reclaim a politics grounded not in hate and division, but in decency, common decency. This is a chance to say enough's enough. There's a chance to reject candidates and appointees who are openly horrible and openly the worst versions of themselves, especially in the text world. And understand, it's a moment to insist on integrity and to rebuild a party that represents all Americans and not just the fringe, the well-connected fringe and their sympathizers. If anything, all of this stuff, all of these painful exposures should be a baby step towards cleansing the Republicans' house. Because look, no true patriot, no real conservative should have to carry the weight of white supremacists and bigots pretending to lead the country. That stain, it's been unmasked. We now see them for who they are. There's no more denying it. And it blew my mind. They're calling us racist. Yeah, you're calling you racist. They're calling us fascists. Hello? Have you seen it? Have you seen the things? They say Donald Trump wants to be a king. Hello? Have you been paying attention? Evidently now, here's the next bit of beauty. Evidently Trump's shaking down his own government. He's shaking down the Department of Justice. His Department of Justice. Evidently wants $230 million in compensation. And I got to imagine pain and suffering for people, for the federal government investigating his crimes. Alleged crimes. Because now we'll never know because, well, they've killed all the investigations. And I got to think doing what authoritarians do really well, rewrite and get rid of history. But $230 million from us, the taxpayers, through his Department of Justice. it would be laughable if it weren't so disgraceful. But that's our dear leader. That's our unitary executive. And like I said, look, they're doing a nice job probably rewriting things. The shredder is probably red hot. And I got to think the shredder is red hot. And the, what's that, that whiteout, that stuff that you put over, you write new stuff. I got the redacted version of the Epstein files is probably complete now, because evidently Speaker Mike Johnson said on, I think it was Tuesday, that he was going to allow a floor vote on a bipartisan bill to fully release the Epstein files. Once the House comes back into session, he was going to do that. He was going to allow a vote. So I can only think, this is, you know, because we've had all of this time, I got to think the work of rewriting that history, complete. The redaction of the redaction of the redactions, pristine. And dear leader will have his name changed. We'll come up with another name for him. Let that sink in for a minute. All of this chaos, all of this insanity, all of this, well, steaming pile of you know what, all done in your name and mine. All the while, the cost of living keeps getting out of hand, wages keep falling, life gets more difficult, and the anger keeps growing. The question is when do we find ourselves? Got a lot to get to today. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Pennsylvania Democratic Party Chair Eugene De Pasquale going to be here to share some thoughts on what they're doing to help all of that. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, the pendulum's swinging a bit. As a new Gallup poll finds that Democrats have retaken the lead in party identification, 48 to 41. And look, after these last several months, anyone surprised? Anyone shocked by that bit of news? No. The fact that 7 million people over the weekend found Obama's comfortable shoes and hit the streets. Are you surprised? No, but it's got to be music to the ears of my next guest, who has taken over the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. One of my favorite former representatives, an all-around good guy, party chair Eugene De Pasquale. Eugene, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, Rick, always a pleasure. Great to see you, brother.
So let's start with, you know, congrats on the new gig. You know, couldn't have got a better guy for that spot, in my view.
Oh, Rick, I appreciate that. We obviously got a lot of work to do. Took over the reins as the fall began, and we obviously have the most important retention election in Pennsylvania history. So had to hit the ground running, but I appreciate that.
Let's start with the Gallup poll. It's got to be music to your ears that more people are identifying with your party. Any thoughts?
Look, I don't want to pop any champagne yet. We still have a lot of work to do. But what certainly matters is what people have seen over the last several months is the chaos of these tariff policies that are driving up prices. You're seeing the government shut down now, trying to rip Medicaid out of the hands of people. And certainly when you're even cutting food nutrition to poor children. So I think part of it is people are simply just rejecting the extremism of the Trump administration.
You brought up the retention elections. For folks who don't know around the country, Pennsylvania has got a big election day on November 4th, one of the most watched in the country. A big day, in my view, for democracy as a whole, as the Keystone State here is going to decide whether or not to retain three state Supreme Court justices. Walk me through why this is gaining national attention, why it's important, and why the rest of the nation should care.
So in 2015, there were three openings in the Supreme Court, and we as Democrats won all three. And Pennsylvania has this sort of quirk of judicial law, which is, or judicial election law, which is every 10 years, they stand for a yes or no vote. And most of those times, those are simply, you know, not very contentious elections. Well, the MAGA billionaire Republicans and the Commonwealth partners have decided to go all in on trying to defeat these Supreme Court justices. And what have they done? They've done their job. They've stood up for the Pennsylvania Constitution. They've stood up for reproductive freedom and abortion rights. They stood up for fair education funding, both for urban and rural schools. They've made sure that every vote was counted, even when Trump won the election and when Biden won the election. And they've stood up for worker rights and the environment. And for that, these MAGA billionaires are trying to make sure that they get a no vote. I think we're going to win. But when you have somebody who's Pennsylvania's richest person spending millions and millions of dollars, it means the race is going to tighten.
Yeah. And look, you had millions of people out in the street across the country, Pennsylvania, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands. This is a good moment. But I think this retention vote, the reason it's gained so much attention, as you said, all of that stuff, but it comes down to voting rights. Ultimately, these are the people who decide, you know, how the game will be rigged for the next election. And that's really the scary part of Pennsylvania could quickly become Utah or Alabama for all I know.
Yeah, Rick. So for you and me as Pennsylvanians, we get a lot of rights that they're protecting. But if you want to talk about the national significance of this, and that is, if they were to basically get rid of these justices, you know, they were the ones that stood up and said the gerrymandered map was unconstitutional and made sure that we had a fair map in Pennsylvania, where sometimes the Democrats have more members of Congress from the state, sometimes the Republicans do, but it's a fair map. There's competitive districts. Voters getting the side, not the politicians getting the side. So if you were to get rid of them, you would go back to re-gerrymandered maps. And also, if you believe that, as I do, that Pennsylvania is the critical swing state in the country, you cannot win the White House without Pennsylvania if you're a Democrat. And in 2028, we also want to make sure that we have justices on the Supreme Court that are making sure that every legally cast vote is actually counted. There's some people that actually don't want that. There's some people that want to make sure that if you voted by mail, there's going to be even more hurdles throughout you. This Supreme Court making sure that actual every legally cast vote gets counted. So from the national perspective, it's making sure that Pennsylvania has free and fair elections. That's why this matters nationally.
Yeah, to steal a Bidenism, this is kind of a big freaking deal. Just for the Keystone State, but for the country as a whole, because it does have that national implication of really turning Pennsylvania into a solid red state by deciding, well, a whole bunch of people, well, your votes aren't going to count.
That's exactly right.
But here's the thing. I mean, there's this energy. And as I said at the top, you know, more people are identifying as Democrats because of what they're seeing coming out of Washington and a lot of these overreaching red states. You saw the weekend, you saw the No Kings rallies here across the Commonwealth and across the country. Give me a thought. How do you take that energy and move it into November 4th and beyond?
So first of all, let's be very clear about this. That was the most extensive protest in American history. There was somewhere in the neighborhood between 7 and 8 million people protesting. That was not just a big city issue. That was not just a blue state issue. That was in every city, every town, every part of this country, standing up to the extremism of Trump. Now, what we did in Pennsylvania was we also had people out there registering people to vote. So we made sure that we were doing that. We were getting out our message of voting yes for the retention. We were also making sure that we had our elected officials out there embracing this. You know, because I do think in the past, sometimes the Democratic Party has, for whatever reason, I can't speak for all the reasons for this, has been shied away from some of these protests. To me, this was about something embracing it, because even though, you know, we may have some disagreements inside our party as are natural, we all share a disagreement that the Trump administration is unhinged.
Yeah. Now, for me, the moment for you and for Democrats as a whole is to take this energy and reclaim a message that resonates with the working class of this country. Because understand, the right's anger, I believe, is justified.
I believe
working people on the right wearing the MAGA hats, I believe their anger is justified, just as it is on the other side. So it would be great if we had a message that said, hey, we're going to make life better. We're going to bring down prices. We're going to do all the things that we were told Trump as dictator was going to do on day one. Not tear down part of the White House and build some gaudy monument to his ego, but to actually do something to help working people, survive, put food on the table, keep a roof over that, that kind of stuff.
Corporate special interests has screwed middle America for close to three decades. And as much as I'm a Bill Clinton fan, it started with NAFTA. And some of these trade deals, look, and I know we have to have international trade as well, we should, but some of these trade deals hurt American workers, hurt American manufacturing. And then you had the financial crisis in 2008, people losing their homes, bankers getting bailed out. So you've had a resentment for a lot of people in the corporate rule. And Trump preyed on that. He didn't do anything about it, but he preyed on it. And so what he did in this last budget is he made it even worse. He cut taxes for these people and is ripping Medicaid out of the hands of struggling Americans. But we as Democrats, we have to understand that the same people that we say we represent and you and I want to represent, they're frustrated with our party as well because they don't think we've delivered on what we should be delivering on. So I'm hopeful that in 2028, we're going to get another chance. The next time around, when that happens, we have to deliver, whether it's paid family leave, whether it's actually increasing the minimum wage, actually strengthening union rights. I think we should do all of it because there's one thing I think Trump has done that we should understand. And that is he drives to get his agenda done. And look, sometimes as Democrats, we'll say, oh, if we do it that way, it will look bad. Let's actually deliver for the American people first.
Yep.
And then worry about some of the semantics of how it looks later. Let's actually deliver for them. That's one thing I'm going to give him his due. When he delivers for his base, you and I may not like what he delivers for his base, but he delivers for his base. We should actually, if we commit to delivering for middle class and working families, the public will reward that. But they're frustrated because we don't always deliver because we say, oh, it's hard or this and that. I'm telling you, we've got to find a way to deliver the next time we're in power.
No, because Eugene, this is one of the things that I keep getting from people going, the pendulum is swinging so far to the extreme right. Right. Trump and the Republicans are moving us into this fascistic kind of direction. Will Democrats bring that pendulum back? But that hasn't happened in my lifetime. We've been slowly marching to the right, slowly marching. And when Democrats do take power, they never go back to correct. I look at this gaudy monument to Trump's ego that they're building with non-union labor, mind you. Right. I'm of the mindset the first thing that Democrats should do if they take office, tear that damn thing down and rebuild something that the American people can be proud of.
I would love to. I would love to put a workers' memorial there or something. First of all, the whole thing, when I say the whole thing, I'm not talking about your question. What he's doing there is just absolutely ridiculous. It's insane in every stretch. It's gaudy. It's tacky. It's all of that stuff. But it also shows you where his priorities are. He actually doesn't care about average, everyday working Americans. He doesn't care. His policies have made it worse. But we've got to do a better job of delivering on this because I think we're pretty good right now articulating the message why he's bad. But we've got to also put out there what we're going to do for average everyday work in America.
Right. And part of this is, the government shut down right now. And the blame is from a lot of my red hat people. It's all the Democrats because they want to save. And the narrative that they've been fed is they want to save health care for illegals. And I'm going, no, they want to save healthcare for Americans and Americans in red states, which is why, you get 13 Republicans sign a letter to send to Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, and hey, we want to do something on the ACA subsidies. We want to have a vote. We want to do something. And oddly enough, two of those Republicans right here from your state of Pennsylvania.
Well, so Rick, it's one thing to say, oh, your prices are going to go up. It's another thing when the prices actually are going up. So people are starting to get those premium notices right now. If you're on the Pennsylvania exchange, you are going to see your premiums go up somewhere close to 75%. So people are starting to feel this right now. That's why those Republicans signed that letter, because their constituents are getting hit with that right now. So this isn't some theoretical, oh, somewhere down the line. This price increase for people is happening right now, and it's devastating.
No, and this is where, you know, the power of we the people comes into play. And as the misery of this administration trickles down, there's going to be an opportunity. So this, again, I come to you as the lead Democrat in this state saying, hey, we got to have that message that's going to say, this is the way forward. This is the vision. This is what we do. And I got to tell you, I'm not seeing it yet.
Yeah. No, I'm doing my, and by the way, I got to continue doing this. I am hammering, well, and when I say hammering, obviously it's in a polite way, but talking to our congressional candidates saying, you've got to run on an agenda, not just that Trump is bad. Talk about what you're going to do for average everyday working families, and making sure, even when I talk to national folks, that we've got to have, in a sense, our own Project 2025, call it Project 2029, whatever it is, where this is what we're going to actually deliver for the American people, if the American people entrust us with power again.
No, Project Restore the American Dream, Project Restore Prosperity and Reward to Work. I'll call it whatever you want, but have a plan, and I'm with you. I got to ask you, though, as you know, the top Democrat in the state, the head of the party here, John Fetterman's got to be causing you some headaches. I mean, the recent news, and look, I support doing away with the filibuster. It's just weird that it's for this moment. You got anything on that front?
Look, John's our senator, you know, and I obviously hear it from all angles there, as you can imagine. But I'm not a big fan of the filibuster either. But if we're going to do it, we should do it in across the board. The Senate right now is really not functioning as a democratic institution. But Democrats right now at least have a seat at the table by them needing the 7 votes. If you wanted to get rid of it on everything, I could at least understand that. But it shouldn't be on just this one. I think that's wrong.
No, I'm right there with you. And it's one of those things that I know bad things would happen without it, but that's what democracy is. And that gives
look, maybe that would send a message that actually, like, winning and losing has consequences. Yep. I mean, you know, I think if you're going to do this, it should be an across the board issue. But it shouldn't be just on this one. I've got a real issue there. But if it's going to be on across the board, then it sends a message. Hey, folks, you better get out and vote because it's going to matter.
Yeah. Lastly, I got to get your thoughts on my Congressman, Scott Perry, former head of the House Freedom Caucus. Did a radio interview not too long ago, said that Democrats, you guys, hate the military. He said that the only reason Democrats join the military is to get credentials to run for office. He said they join the military, they serve a little bit, they get their credentials, and they run for office and wear the uniform and say, hey, look at me, I support America. He says, but let's face it, all their votes don't support America because, well, Perry says they don't care about the Constitution or the nation's defense. I find all of that reprehensible and ridiculous and sadly hyper-divisive of our military, and the kind of thing that someone who was pretty high up in the National Guard, you really wouldn't expect or shouldn't expect.
No, first of all, we should not be I know the water's over the dam with some of these folks, Perry especially, but you should not be politicizing the actual personnel in the military. They didn't ask to be put in the middle of that fight. And many people, whether they're Republican, Democrat, let's be clear, some of them aren't registered, some of them are independent. In fact, a lot of them are independent because they don't want to be torn into the R versus D divide. They just want to do their job in the military. So to me, for him to throw that out there is really disgusting. So full stop. Secondly, beyond that, you know, there are a lot of Democrats that, in fact, if anything, I would say even more Democrats support the actual military personnel. Maybe, you know, Democrats, and I think even a increasing number of Republicans, including Donald Trump, are skeptical of forever wars. And so to me, that is actually being pro-military defense or pro-military personnel. Yep. So do you mean you are pro-military personnel if you are a skeptic of further adventures? That is completely different. If you are skeptical of us entering in wars without a clear-cut strategy, without a clear-cut exit strategy, you're actually looking out for our personnel. That, to me, is someone who is pro-military and pro-American.
Or beyond that, I'm very skeptical of putting those soldiers on our streets to do police work in our cities.
Look, if we need to have more law enforcement in the United States, we should be working with our cities, boroughs, and towns to hire more local law enforcement. We should not be having the National Guard doing that job. That's just about Trump trying to show his military might.
Yeah, and that's the sad reality. Last bit. What's the message coming out of this new Kings this No Kings rally? What's the hope that you think is going to come? What opportunities do you see, or are there any?
I think there is strength in numbers. I think there were a whole lot of people that were probably despondent going into that, saw the big crowds, and now they realize, oh, there's a lot of people that are concerned like me. I think that's going to prompt a lot more people to vote this November.
That is the hope. Eugene, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great stuff. I hope to see you again real soon.
You got it, Rick. I look forward to it.
Our good friend Eugene DePasquale, chair of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, padems.org, the website. You want to take a look at that? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
Catch Farm Report updates throughout the day from the Midwest Farm Report right here on 98.9 WXCO.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A cloudy sky tonight, some showers around, and a low in the mid-30s. More clouds are ahead for tomorrow, highs in the mid-40s. Friday, we're back into sunshine, highs in the upper 40s. And 50s are ahead with sun this weekend. It's 39 right now.
This is Robert Pilot, host of Native Earth Radio. On our show, we talk about Native issues like treaties, protecting Mother Earth, and holding our elected officials accountable. You'll also hear from Turtle Island voices like Arvina Martin, State Representative Heather Keeler, Ruth Anna Buffalo, Dr. Anthony Stately, State Senator Mary Kunish, Robert Lilligren, and Bob Blake. Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, a bunch of email on one talking point, but I'm gonna pick Jerry's out of the bag. And Jerry, you're the lucky one for today. He writes, "Come on, Rick. We all know that George Soros paid those people in the streets $500 apiece to show up at those rallies." He then goes on to cite his sources, and good for him. Look, I love when people cite their sources. A Fox Digital article that quoted the CEO of a crowd hire company, obviously used by the right. Another source was Trump's comments on October 19th, calling the protest a joke, but also saying that all the signs look like they were paid for by Soros. And then some comment that Laura Ingraham made on her program. So really reliable sources. And, you know, you stop and think about $500 to show up for, maybe I would show up for $500, but 7 million people, $500. My math isn't all that great, but that sounds like about $3.5 billion. I know Soros is rich, but I got to wonder about $3.5 billion for a 1-day gig. I don't know. And here to share some thoughts on the big rally day and maybe where this goes from here, I've asked Jackson Potter to come share some thoughts. Jackson's the vice president of the Chicago's Teachers Union, CTU Local1.org, their website. Jackson, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, great being here. Yeah, I mean, look, that's an anti-Semitic trope, but also patently false. You know, we know that at least a few hundred of our members, educators, attended the rally. They certainly didn't get paid. I went to one in Rosemont, Illinois. We had nearly 300,000 people in downtown Chicago, to your point. You know, I think that would bankrupt most billionaires. And certainly the people I know who attended these rallies and events, it's because they're outraged that Trump is sending military and ICE into our cities to kidnap grandmas, selling tamales, to traumatize children walking to school, to snatch people off the streets, to send Black Hawk helicopters rappelling troops down into buildings on the Black South Side and zip-tying citizens and putting people in vans for Black people and other vans for immigrants. It's the Gestapo tactics that is firing up people who want to protect their constitutional rights, who want to defend basic vital services for the public, for our schools, for transit, that are being undermined by Trump's billionaire tax breaks. If there's anybody paying people, it's Trump paying the wealthiest cabinet in human history, his own, and giving them massive tax breaks at the expense of working people.
But it's easier to use these kind of tropes, as you put it, to divide people, because really that's all they've got, is to be able to divide the working class. Because look, the anger is real. It's just who you're mad at. And, well, the right has a machine that keeps feeding people like Jerry this kind of rhetoric that's meant only to divide, not to solve any problems, but to cause more.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, we see it in all the kind of false narratives about public education, even though, you know, 90% of the population depends on public schools, from the wealthiest districts to the poorest districts. It's a public good. It serves the vast majority. It's, you know, people love their educators and teachers in their community, depend on them. You know, it's kind of the lifeblood of the country. And yet still there's this effort to dismantle what works and defund it and undermine it. And so I think we're all standing together now saying, look, our democratic traditions, as incomplete and, you know, insufficient as they might be, are being undermined before our eyes. And we need to stand up and demand that working people have basic things like the ability to tell their bosses that they're not being paid enough, to form a union, to speak out about tyranny, to be able to exercise free speech without being threatened with a trial, an investigation, or jail, and, you know, sending out to a black site in a foreign land. Like, this is what's happening right now, and people are waking up and saying they've had enough.
Yeah, but, you know, the reality is and before the weekend came, we were told it was all the worst of the worst, Jackson. It was going to be the Marxists, the Antifa, the, you throw in the boogeyman. That's what all was going to be in the street. It was going to be violence. We were going to need the National Guard. We were going to have to come down with the iron fist of the law. And then you get 7 million people to show up in the streets and peacefully assemble to do exactly what you were saying. It doesn't fit the narrative. Now we got to go to, well, this was all staged.
Yeah, I mean, it's just boggles the mind, these arguments. It doesn't track reality. And that should beg the question, like, what are they trafficking? If they can pretend like 7 million people don't have the agency and ability to mobilize on a day off and take personal time to engage in one of the greatest American traditions, the protest movement, and demand things that are very elementary. I want freedom of speech. I don't want to be silenced. I don't want my neighbors locked up for just trying to have a decent living. You know, I want an economic system that serves the many, not the few. And that is what they are objecting to, right? Ultimately, you have to see, what are their policies doing for whom? That's the question all your listeners and everybody in the public should be asking.
Yeah.
What are the actual material results of these efforts? Is it to help average workers and their families, or is it to help the billionaires and the 1%?
Well, it goes back to my, you know, what my high school government teacher told me a gazillion years ago. Government decides who gets what, and the wealth class of this country have figured that out, and they're getting what they want. So for me, in looking at this protest and this movement that is growing, one, how do educators like you, how do your members use this moment not just to educate students, but to engage them in a way that maybe they take on the empowering view that they can change the future and that they can have some input into what their country is going to look like?
Yeah, I mean, we've been having conversations we never thought were going to be front and center with our students, with families around. You know, is this still a democracy? You know, many academics 1 month into Trump's second administration say we've ceased being a democracy. If you can't say what you think without fear of retaliation, if you can't have a union job at the federal level without being deprived of those rights, if you can't speak out against the government without, you know, a grand jury threatening you and your life and liberty, then, you know, we have to start investigating what are the basic pillars and foundation of the country, and are they being destroyed before our eyes? And what has happened in other countries where we have seen similar things occur, whether it's South Korea or Hungary or Serbia, and how have popular movements come together to express outrage and clarity around transformation and what's needed to stop authoritarians from destroying our fundamental rights? And this country is a tradition of that, right? Where Black people left plantations to destroy the system of slavery, which is the most vile and oppressive system that we've probably seen throughout history. And that helped make the Union more democratic. It helped eradicate white supremacy from, you know, our founding document and improve things like, you know, having the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, expanded the franchise, and, you know, created a public accommodations like the Freedmen's Bureau that developed our first public education, medical systems, and the Department of Justice. So, you know, when you're talking about civics, you actually have to talk about, like, what has happened in history? What were the intentions? How have we evolved? And what's being done to, you know, really go and destroy those things that have been achieved through, you know, generations of struggle.
Yeah, no, I go back and, you know, thinking about my education and, you know, learning about the 30s and the rise of fascism. And the question kept coming up, how is it possible that people didn't know? How is it possible this was allowed to happen? And now I'm old enough to look back and go, geez, I'm kind of now getting it, which is because we've kind of, you know, frog in the water kind of moved into a situation where still a large portion of our population doesn't believe Trump is doing anything wrong whatsoever, which is saddening.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it takes us doing civics nationwide, you know, like everybody needs some basic context and reference points because the media system is so distracting. It can be difficult to get your bearings. And so it's our job, too, to have some simple reference points to share with people that may disagree on basic things. So, for example, you know, in 1926, Mussolini, you know, eradicated union rights for those who wouldn't declare loyalty to the fascist regime. Well, guess what just happened? Trump did the same thing at the federal level. He exempted the Teamsters because Sean O'Brien bent the knee at the Republican National Convention. We should be very afraid at the direction this is headed, and we should remind our neighbors, you know, people across red, blue, and purple districts that, you know, the future could be much more of a dystopia than any of us predicted if we're not careful and don't embrace our fundamental rights together.
So as an organizer, you know, you look at this rally and the movement that's being built. The weekend was an incredible display of power, of unity, of positive messaging. Where does it go from here? What's the plan? What are you hoping comes of this? I guess there's where we begin.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing is a pretty significant realignment of political sentiment across the ideological spectrum, where, you know, a majority of Americans are facing down to the realization that their government no longer represents them, that is a government of the rich for the rich. It's a plutocracy, and it's one that is increasingly authoritarian. And that just goes against the grain of most of us. And so that's why you're seeing the largest protests in American history. And it is providing us with kind of a new opportunity to coalesce. What would it take to transform a system that has brought us to the brink? You know, because it's not working for most people, because they are living paycheck to paycheck, because corporations are making record profits while people are, you know, struggling to pay bills and for their groceries. And so, you know, it really does raise the prospect of us building new coalitions that can, for the first time, win national health care. You know, Sean Fain from the UAW. And just the other day at the No Kings rally, our mayor, Brandon Johnson, have called for a general strike. Sarah Nelson of the airline workers. You know, we have growing numbers of people who, like the South Korean workers, are saying, if this goes much further, maybe we have to, not comply.
Maybe you don't have to comply. And this is what we talked about yesterday with Richard Hooker. When we spoke with Richard Hooker yesterday on the program, he talked about a general strike. And the question I threw back at him, Jackson, was, it's a great idea. I'm all in favor of it. I'd be right there at the front of it. But when you're talking about less than 6% of the private sector workforce, less than 10% of the entire workforce, do you really have the power in numbers to be able to really, really make change?
Well, I'll say this, to your point, majority of American workers don't have unions, but they want them. And a majority of workers with unions haven't taken a strike action, while they're under contract, because in most states that would be illegal. But most workers do have sick days. They do have the right to withdraw from the economy, periodically. And if we were to pool that sentiment together and organize and align a day of action, similar to No Kings, but on a work day, to disrupt and demonstrate our displeasure with the way things are going and where they're headed, and put some pressure on the corporate rulers that, have funded MAGA and are in their cabinet and are continuing to donate to a political system that's corrupt, as you put it, then I think we get things like, Target starting to bend the pressure of having the lowest sales recently because of a boycott, or Disney restoring, comedians on their network because people are starting to withdraw from their services. We've done that with Tesla. Could we do that with Salesforce and Palantir and Home Depot, who are fueling the military occupation of our cities and the terror being rained down upon Black and brown and immigrant communities, and using our resources against us and sequestering funds that are supposed to be going to things that we need and deserve, like childcare, transit, public education, healthcare. So I think it's a wake-up call, and increasingly more and more people that I talk to, regular people, are saying, I'm willing to take action, even if it means doing something I've never been willing to do before.
No, it's the kind of organizing that, every generation has to figure out how to rediscover. And I say all the time, solidarity is something every generation has to figure out. This is kind of our moment, isn't it?
Truly is. And it's a moment like on no other. Great peril comes with tremendous promise. We know from our history that the greatest movement in the 1920s was the Ku Klux Klan, 5 million members, a wretched racist operation that was then eclipsed by the CIO, who was organizing workers and sit-down strikes in Flint and the steel mills. And that transformed the country. It allowed for a New Deal that, for the first time, made sure that our senior citizens had support and weren't going to die, without food or rent, and were able to get Social Security instead, was able to recognize unions for the first time in our country's history, put people back to work who were unemployed and on food lines. So that's the kind of transformation that we can look upon and take heart in, that we are capable of doing again.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, clearly a very successful rally day, very successful in getting people out. Hopefully the organizing will continue. What are you hoping comes in the next several days? And what's the marching order for those of us who want to be involved, who want to take that next step towards getting to where you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a lot of efforts to, build other protests in the near future at vetssayno.org. There are a number of veteran organizations that are building events on November 8th, like Common Defense, for town halls to challenge our political leaders who are cutting veteran services while rewarding billionaire donors. Simultaneously, About Face is helping build Veterans Day events on November 11th. Many of us have a federal holiday that day. Let's go support veterans who are saying no to occupation, no to Trump's troops, no to ICE terror for our working class neighbors and immigrant families, you know, no to cuts to public services and accommodation, and yes to taxing the rich to ensure we all have access to affordable housing, healthcare, excellent public education systems, and the like.
There you go. Jackson Potter, I appreciate you taking time for us. Keep up the great work, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Yeah, would love to, and thanks for the work you do, too. Thanks appreciate so much. You.
Jackson Potter, vice president there of the Chicago Teachers Union. You can check out their website, ctulocal1.org. We'll get links out on social media on how you can do that. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day that the bank robber known as Pretty Boy Floyd was gunned down by federal agents in Ohio. He was born Charles Arthur Floyd in 1904 in Georgia. His family moved to Oklahoma when he was a boy. Like many Oklahomans during this era, he fell on hard economic times. Floyd turned to crime. He did a four-year stretch in a Missouri prison for payroll robbery. When he got out, he tried to get a job in the Oklahoma oil fields. Unable to find work, Floyd took up bank robbing. He robbed banks in Kentucky, Ohio, and Missouri. He got caught and convicted in Ohio, but escaped on his train trip to prison. He made his way back to Oklahoma. There he became a folk hero. Locals called him the Robin Hood of the Cookson Hills. Legend had it that Floyd destroyed mortgage papers when he robbed banks, winning him friends among farmers reeling from the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. Floyd became a national fugitive when he was accused of killing federal agents in Kansas City. He denied he was ever involved in the killings. J. Edgar Hoover, head of the U.S. Bureau of Investigation, named Floyd public enemy number one. Finally, the law caught up with Floyd in an Ohio cornfield. His body was returned to Oklahoma, where as many as 40,000 came to his funeral. Woody Guthrie remembered Floyd in song.
But a many a starving farmer, the same old story told. How the outlaw paid their mortgage and saved their little home.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Others tell you about a stranger that come to beg a meal. Underneath his napkin left a $1,000 bill.
So yesterday we talked about the Trump Shrine and how Trump has got scab contractors tearing apart the East Wing. Hillary Clinton said that this is a case of Trump destroying the White House. She said it's not his house, it's your house, and he's destroying it. And yeah, kind of. Forever. I mean, this is part of his legacy. And we're told it's going to be totally private. A total ballroom project is going to be private. He and Trump insists that his Mag-a-Lago style monstrosity rising from the rubble of the East Wing caused by scab non-union contractors won't cost taxpayers a dime. But I got to tell you, we've kind of seen this show before because this is the same guy who for decades screwed contractors, declared bankruptcy, what, six times? And now swears that this $250 million golden shrine to self-glorification is coming from his I almost can't say it. It's coming from his personal fortune and patriotic donors. And I got to go, hold on, patriotic fortune, personal fortune, patriotic donors. It's kind of translation. Big corporations like Lockheed Martin, Google, RJ Reynolds, they have cut seven-figure checks. for American values. And look, what they're really looking for, better federal contracts, more tax breaks that are going to come down the line. The money funneled through a nonprofit so donors get nice big fat write-offs on their taxes. It's going to end up looking less like philanthropy and more like a masterclass in pay-to-play. Because nothing says draining the swamp like letting the wealthy benefactors etch their names into the White House bricks in exchange for access, or worse, influence. When one of the top ethics lawyers in the country calls it an ethical nightmare, you know the chandelier's already crooked. And here's the thing. Let's not kid ourselves. Projects like these never stay privately funded. Once overruns start, and they will, the Secret Service maintenance, the security upgrades, all seem to, they'll find their way mysteriously into the federal budget somewhere. So, sure, Trump might not bill taxpayer for the marble columns or the gilded ceilings directly, but wait until the cost of fixing his tacky legacy hit the books. The result? A garish monument to his ego, built on the ruins of democratic integrity. And you and me, we the people, picking up the cleanup bill, fixing the mess that they're going to leave behind. And again, this is one of those moments where you begin to start asking questions of, I thought he was pro-union and for workers, and using a non-union contractor sends a really loud and clear message. But this idea that we're opening it up to corporations who do business before our government just reeks of, well, another shakedown. And I've told this story before. Right after it was 2013, we went to Dallas. And we got a really nice tour. And I want to thank the people at the George W. Bush Presidential Library. Gave us a really great full-day tour. Gave us access to wherever we wanted to go. Got to see anything we wanted. Talk to anyone we wanted. They gave us, you know, interview time in the... It was the all the stuff that they had taken from the Situation Room when they after 9/11 realized how badly they were outdated in technology, and they updated, to their credit, updated all the new stuff. But all the old stuff they took to Dallas and put in the Presidential Library, which we got to be part of. We got to sit in the actual chairs and in the actual room where, you know, Bush and all the other people were trying to figure out what to do on 9/11. They gave us that kind of access. But there was only one question they would not answer. And it wasn't that they didn't know, because I asked him, I said, do you know? And he's like, yeah, but I'm not going to tell you. You're never going to know. Which is, how much did it cost to etch corporations or billionaires' names into the granite columns that you walk into the main entrance and see? Our billionaire class was on display right there in the atrium. Wouldn't tell how much it cost to get the name etched in there. And this is going to be the same thing. I hope they at least do us the honor of plastering, you know, posters like at the ball games. I mean, if we're going to treat this as a pay to play thing, it should be like a NASCAR ballroom. We should know who's funded it, and we should know who we have to make right on the other side. So for me, I think this is another monstrosity. I think it's going to be a horrible thing. And I think it's going to be gaudy. I think it's going to be the laughing stock of our country. The world is going to look at this and go, look what King Donald did. Look how bad. Because, you know, I've seen some of the pictures. I don't know. Needs an interior decorator. But I want to hear your thoughts. Do you think this could be a source of national pride? Or like me, it's going to be just a gaudy nightmare. rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, download the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. President Trump slaps new sanctions against Russia as it continues its war against Ukraine. CBS's Linda Kenyon.
The sanctions are against Russia's two largest oil companies.
I just felt it was time.
President Trump speaking in the Oval Office with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte.
These are tremendous sanctions. These are very big. Those are against their two big oil companies. And we hope that they won't be on for long. We hope that the war will be settled.
The Secretary General praised the move.
It's all about changing the calculus.
And he said ramping up the pressure on Russia to end this war. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, the White House.
The U.S. has just announced a ninth strike against a suspected drug smuggling boat in the Pacific Ocean, leaving three dead. Earlier today, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said the U.S. struck an eighth suspected drug vessel in the eastern Pacific, two people killed. CBS News military consultant Jeff McCausland says of